We don't really give a lot of really personalized information necessarily. We will discuss things with the client, but primarily we're giving answers to questions. For other sources, if, for instance, you're a sex therapist, when you do sex education, you're going to want to do a lot more personalized, a lot more intimate, and a lot more detailed sex information about somebody's specific situation. On the web, I think it's a particularly it's a particularly variable type of sex education that you can give, both because the web is so interactive compared to books, which were the primary way that people got sex information before the internet. And at the same time, you put out a lot of information that you don't control where it goes. So you have to be very aware of where this of how appropriate this information is for the general viewer.
Thanks. With VP and the sexual communication studies that I do personally, I've noticed that there are several main thrusts of sexual education. There's health information, right? How do you get pregnant? How do you not get pregnant? How do you get STDs? How do you avoid them? But then there's also the sorts of techniques, you know, how do you give a good blowjob? How do you enjoy yourself in bed? So there's a number of different aspects of sexual education, and it's very interesting to see where some sources are willing to cover one of those aspects and not the other. Particularly, a lot of the official sex education that you get in school is much more willing to talk about the health aspect, but not at all willing to talk about what you might enjoy out of sex or any sorts of technique information.
I should probably add that actually I got a little bit off track in my answer to that question, but that is a good breakdown that basically you're talking both about health information and you're talking about more relationship information, and you're also talking about more pleasure information, and pleasure information can also take the form of talking to people about things that turn them on, about things that are not necessarily just about physical pleasure but maybe about psychological pleasure or about relationship issues.
Great. So another question I was going to work on was, how does the easy and fairly private access to porn that we get online affect people's sex lives? I know when I've been taking a look at the questions that we get on VP, we see a number of people who start to ask questions about sexual practices that they've seen in pornography but haven't necessarily heard about in their own personal lives. So there's a lot more women, I think, asking questions about anal sex now than really you got for a very long time, because in kind of the middle of the country, anal sex is the gay thing. And now that people have a lot more easy access to pornography, they're starting to see that, hey, this is a pretty normal thing. People enjoy this. And so you get a lot more people finding themselves interested in practices that otherwise might have been a little bit off kilter for them. What do you think?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Sure. All right. How does the fairly easy access
to pornography affect people's sex lives? Well, I think it's really important to note that porn does have a profound effect on people's sex lives, and that people act out things that they see in porn sometimes, not always. And it's a mistake to assume that people are always going to act out what they want to see in porn. People should have permission to watch porn, jerk off to porn that has nothing to do with what they want to do in their real life. And people do that a lot, but people also are going to you know, act on behaviors that they see. I think anal sex is a perfect example. Shaved pubic hair on women is a perfect example. To a lesser extent, shaving and stuff like that on men. I think that, you know, transgender identity can relate to this, that for a lot of people, seeing representations of transgender people in porn allows them to find either a transgender identity, or maybe if they want to identify as somebody who's into, you know, who's a tranny chaser or something like that. I think that that's really important. I think gay and lesbian porn is really important. I can't tell you the number of women that I've known who were sort of turned on by images of female and female sexuality that they saw in straight porn, also in the mainstream media, which I think is sort of a splash over from porn. And that sort of gave them permission to explore being bisexual, in some cases, you know, being lesbian. And definitely with any kind of queer sexuality or any kind of unusual sexuality, having porn can be a reinforcement. Having porn that represents that can be a reinforcement. Not so much that this is okay, although that's an element of it, but just that this is something that people do, and that this is, it reinforces the idea that this exists rather than being something that, you know, is wrong. I believe, I can't remember if it was, I don't remember who it was. Earlier today, we talked about sort of the person, you know, somebody who feels like the only gay man in Nebraska. You know, it's pretty, it's harder to feel like that. I think people still do feel like that, and I think that's the nature of the web being limited in the interactions it can offer. But I do think that very few people legitimately actually think, you know, I'm the only gay person in the world after the web. And you know, I think it's a little hard to support that. So these things, really do reinforce the idea that behaviors can be variant.
Thanks. So in the original abstract of my talk, I spoke about how one of the things that we tend to find with VP is that not only are we communicating info about health and about pleasure, but we're also communicating an attitude of sex positivity. Like what Thomas was just saying about this attitude of tolerance towards people of alternative lifestyles, different kinks, that sort of thing. When we have an open forum where it's not okay to say, hey, screw you guys, we communicate this attitude that, hey, sexuality is a positive thing and that you can explore all of these different varieties of it. And so one of the most positive interactions I've seen with the various forum members at VP is how people are suddenly coming to the understanding that queer people and trans people aren't just these weirdo freaks that they would never, ever know, but are starting to become a lot more educated about the spectrum of gender, that sort of thing. So I mentioned in my original abstract that it seemed to me that the internet presents a fairly sex-positive environment where that's often communicated. But when I was speaking with somebody who was interested in joining this panel but couldn't make it this time of night, it was suggested that maybe some of the fragmentation creates an attitude where it sort of seems like it's sex positive because there's all of this variety of kink, but maybe it's a little bit more fragmented and it's sort of my kink is okay, but your kink is a little bit too much. So that's an idea that I hadn't really considered before coming from my particular background, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I think that it's a really good question to posit whether or not the internet results in a sex positive space. I mean, I guess the answer would be the same, you know, as does any public life ever result in anything specific. but I think that the what you do see on the internet is that you see so much availability of specific fetishes that I think you see a real tendency to have those fetishes reinforced. Often for commercial gain, but also for trading communities. I think this is less true with Web 2.0 than I thought it would be. But back when we had a lot of action in Yahoo groups, I guess this would have been pre-Web 2.0, but it was more interactive, Yahoo groups were just a hotbed of perversion, of every conceivable fetish, and you would be able to sort of access so much free porn and so much free writing about a particular fetish, like, you know, women in gags, or, you know, women with one leg, or, you know, guys with no chest hair, or whatever, that it was really a reinforcing, it was a reinforcing force. And I think that in itself, it's not that I see a sex negativity there. I see a problematization of behaviors that are sort of so reinforced that people start to feel pressure and they start to maybe serve a purpose in people's lives that isn't necessarily the best thing. So I think that because there's such an information overload and such a specificity of information on the internet that you can end up with a real, fragmenting, as you were saying, of places where people feel comfortable with their sexuality, and their sexuality may be so strongly reinforced that it may actually sort of encourage them not to be as open to other things. Whether it's a net gain, I think ultimately the internet is a net gain for sexual information. But I do think that there can be an effect. It also encourages, in many ways, free speech. So I think it encourages people to express sort of objectionable ideas. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think in general it's a good thing, but I think it can be a little bit, it can be a little bit hard to read sometimes some of the stuff that people say online, particularly if you're operating an open forum like you're talking about. People may say things that really are not okay. And I guess, you know, I think that for a sex ed forum or something like that, you have to make the decision of what are we trying to achieve here, and at what point do we say, okay, look, you're, you know, being problematic, and you can call them sex negative, or you can call them disruptive, or you can call them trolls or whatever. I think a moderator has to be there and has to be willing to make the call and basically censor somebody and say, you know what, what you just posted is not appropriate for this forum. Take it elsewhere. And I think people are often reluctant to do that, but I think that otherwise online life just descends into sex negativity.
That brings up a really excellent point. One of the issues that we've had with our forum is that we have a fairly strong stance on what we call victim blaming. And that is the attitude that somebody who has been assaulted is somehow responsible for that assault. And that can be pretty obvious, like, hey, you shouldn't have worn that short skirt, but it can also be fairly subtle, like saying, well, you probably shouldn't have had so much to drink. I mean, in some sense, yes, you should be watching out for yourself, but just because you drank too much doesn't mean that somebody else had the right to violate your space and to assault you in some fashion. And so we've taken a very hardline stance on what is acceptable to say in terms of victim blaming. And a lot of times somebody will come on to VP and say, I had this situation, I got totally drunk, and I came on to this guy, but then I said no, and we had sex anyways. Was that rape? And that's a very difficult question when somebody comes to you with something that's obviously very traumatic to them. And you can't exactly say, well, we're not going to answer your question. But at the same time, you also want to provide some sort of limit and make this a safe space to talk about it. So one of the issues that we've had is we've placed fairly strict limits on what we were willing to say in terms of this victim blaming policy. Now, for that reason, one of the most amazing things that I've seen in our community is that people will come there and say these sorts of things. Say, I had this really scary situation. I don't know what I should do about it. And they'll get fairly personal. And I think that's one of the things that's really nice about that. But at the same time, we get other people who are saying, well, you're shutting down discussion, et cetera, et cetera. Our response to that has always been, there's a whole lot of places out there that you can have those sorts of discussions about what is and what isn't rape without talking about somebody's personal trauma. But from what you bring up here, it is a very difficult decision on when do you make that moderator call to say, hey, at this point, this kind of crosses the line into possibly furthering somebody's trauma.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important point to make. I just strongly believe that as objectionable as many of us feel it is to play the censor, I think that it's absolutely necessary to play the moderator because otherwise a conversation could just devolve into things that are not functional. And I think that that's something that moderators should be aware of, that they're actually, to some degree, they are shutting down discourse because on some level you have to in order to keep a conversation meaningful, I think, at times.
Great. And so along that same line, I wanted to ask you, and in fact I'll ask the audience later, how can sex educators make the best use of the internet and other technologies to get more and better information to more people? One of my own ideas on this is to have things like personal forums and wikis that are maintained by members of the public, which, again, you get the same sorts of problems we get with the reliability of information, but at the same time, it provides a sense of personal responsibility for that information that gets people a little bit more involved in that sex education. So it's not just that they're going to read something and it maybe does or doesn't sink in, but they're going to become a part of it, to become a part of community of education that makes these parts of those integral values.
I'm a big advocate of peer education and particularly of wikis, and particularly the one that I have the most experience with, probably everybody does for the most part, is Wikipedia. And I think that there the place that I could see the most improvement is that I think of precisely what you're saying about the reliability of information is not as closely monitored when it comes to sexuality topics. I think that it's not, that if you're talking about engineering, you're talking about computers, you're talking about something like that, somebody posts something that's just weird, freaky, crazy, it's down really quickly. Or you know, you're talking about the history of you know, Sweden or any kind of real technical topic. They've got a lot of experts monitoring, and I really think that the information is remarkably high quality. In sex, I think that it's a little more of a crapshoot, and I think that I would like to see more people with not necessarily formal educations, but with strong sex education backgrounds being willing to sort of take over the moderating of other people's information rather than having to either provide the information as sex educators or sort of only moderate personal information, but actually provide it in an encyclopedic form, because I think that's really important and is really is a lot less charged. I think the encyclopedic form can be so important to sex education discourse because you're providing it without a lot of the charge that that, you know, a lot of personal, more direct peer education can really be intense and can be either a big turn on to somebody or can punch buttons for them or something like that. And I think that encyclopedic, you know, is good because it's neutral. Or tries to be.
One of the things that's very interesting about what you mentioned is to have somebody who's an expert in sexuality, right? What does that mean? I've definitely heard the old trope, you know, that everybody thinks they can do two things, drive and fuck. And you don't really get certificates in either one of those. I mean, in some places, but but one of the things that I think is very interesting is that when we're talking about who is and isn't a sexuality expert, I think a little bit more so than engineering, up to each person to decide. And that's both liberating and frustrating at the same time. So I wanted to go ahead and take a little bit of a different tack. You bring up reliability of information. This isn't something that I've seen as much, but I was wondering what we think are the biggest gaps in the average American sexual education, and if it's easier to answer these questions online. I know one of the things that I've seen with VP a lot is just some basic questions of biology, right? Because a lot of people come to us, and they're, you know, maybe 17 in some cases, maybe 20, who have just come out of school, who most of their education in terms of the biological aspects of sex has been, you know, a diagram that they saw for maybe 10 minutes and got a test on once. So I've seen people come to VP terribly, terribly frightened that they've got cancer because they found this lump in their vagina, and it's actually their cervix. So the first inclination is to kind of laugh and say, hey, isn't that funny? But then you realize how incredibly sad that is, that we're not teaching people these things that they need to know to realize when they are healthy and when they're not. Because if at a certain point, if they don't know that that is normal, then maybe they'll go to a doctor, but maybe they won't, and maybe what they actually have is something awful. Right? So one of, I think, the biggest gaps that I've seen is just the real basic biology of sex. You know, Violet Blue mentioned earlier today having heard somebody say, you know, oh my God, my boyfriend came on my leg, am I going to get pregnant? I've definitely seen those sorts of questions too. Is this the same that you found with SFSI?
Well, I'm going to tell a personal story, probably too much disclosure, but I had exactly that experience. I went to the doctor. I was probably about 17. I went to my family doctor, who also happened to be a very close friend of my parents, but I didn't care because I was convinced I had testicular cancer because I had a ridge on one of my testicles. Well, it turns out it's called an epididymis, and all healthy testicles have one, and it's a ridge. It's a place where the seminal vesicles attach, and so I've had that moment of, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm 17 and now I have testicular cancer. And I had a fairly good sex education. What was missing was what things feel like. And that was also missing when I started to have partnered sex. It was actually missing when I started to masturbate too. I think that the personal information about this is what it feels like, this is what your testicles feel like in your hand, this is how you know if that's a normal feeling, is really missing. And that may be a place where the encyclopedic model doesn't actually work so well because it's so individual and so personalized. But yeah, I think that the basic medical information is a critical thing that we really don't get in the United States. I'm not so sure about other parts of the world, but definitely in the U.S., there's very, very little medical information, let alone this is what your balls feel like, or this is what your cervix feels like. There's very little this is what, you know, the actual biology is. And I think that that's really an important thing. But the place that I see sex education being most lacking, and it's made great strides with the greater availability of books on places like Amazon, you know, being able to order stuff over the internet, being able to get information over the internet, but still is more interactive stuff. Like, what is it like to have sex with a person? What do you do when you get naked with the person that you want to be with? You know, what are the actual techniques? And I think people still mostly learn that as they've always learned it, which is by doing it and figuring it out as they go along and having a lot of really ridiculous, embarrassing mistakes made. But I think that's a place where sex ed really doesn't offer as much as it could, and I'd like to see more of that. And I think that personal experience discussion online is sort of the only place that that's really going to be effective.
One of the ways that I found myself extremely interested in sexual communication from an academic point of view is I was taking a class on interpersonal communication, and I started to ask other people in the class where they ever got any of this sexual information. And it was kind of alarming to me how much people depended on their friends for sex information. On the one hand, that's a great idea, but at the same time, there were people who were making judgments about their friends' sex lives. There were people who were depending on inaccurate information because their friends weren't very well informed in the first place. So one of the things that I think is really useful about having a very wide community like you get in VP is that there is that sort of information checking when somebody has something that is inaccurate. It really just doesn't stick around as long. But also when you get these sorts of maybe a little bit of weird judgment, you take away this personal aspect and turn it into a personal space, but also an anonymous space. And so people feel a lot more free to consider new ideas because they're not worried about their neighbors looking at them askew later. So when you and I were talking about this topic originally, you had mentioned that you wanted to speak on your experience with Good Vibrations and also some of the other technologies that have evolved to help sex education go forward. Go ahead.
Well, Good Vibrations, which is, for those of who may not be familiar with it, is a sex toy store that was basically somewhat built on the model of Eve's Garden in New York, which preceded it a little bit, and founded by Joni Blank in the mid-70s. Carol Queen was here earlier talking about the history of vibrators and some of the vibrators. Good Vibrations was basically founded to, you know, originally to sort of provide these vibrators and provide sexual materials and sexual information specifically to women. And a big part of its mission has always continued to be to provide sex information as well as to provide sexual products. And when I was marketing manager there, that was a really critical part of our mission. And I think that the interesting thing is how much the internet has evolved to project sexual misinformation, that a lot of commercial companies are actually not providing good, you know, sex information. So I just think it's important to remember that you can't always rely on commercial entities to be providing accurate information. You certainly can't rely on the government or any kind of governmental or any kind of healthcare place necessarily. There are a lot of foundations out there that are actually founded on an anti-choice stance or a pro-life stance, which are providing sex information for women. And claim to be nonprofit foundations, claim to be medical foundations that are actually dedicated to stamping out abortions. So they're going to give inaccurate information about abortions, for instance. And that would be one way in which, I think that you have to keep an eye on where your information is coming from. Luckily, I think most of those places have continued to maintain a stance of being medical authorities. They haven't yet learned the peer education model that well, but I'm sure they will very quickly. Maybe after I make these comments, they'll pick it up.
You also get dangerous products, too, like the product Anal Ease, which markets itself as some fabulous new way to try anal sex. And really what it does is it deadens your nerves there, which allows you to injure yourself pretty easily. What has become kind of a recent controversy is the phthalates in dildos. It's a type of plastic that over time can kind of build up in your liver and provide a huge amount of body load in terms of toxicity. So when we get commercial-based sex information, on the one hand, you'll get companies like Good Vibrations or Babeland or some of these others that are founded on almost an activist model, but sometimes you'll get people who are really just in it for the cash. I mean, you find that with any corporate model, really.
I think there's a really important point to be made. I've always heard it pronounced phthalates. I'm not actually sure how it's pronounced, I want to give a shout out to our German speaking watchers and our German speaking hosts, because I believe it was Der Spiegel where we at Good Vibrations, I think just before the publication of an article, I want to say it was Der Spiegel. I'm not sure if I'm remembering the title of the publication correctly, but an article about studies that had been done on phthalates And how they were, somebody spoke with somebody at Good Vibrations, Carol Queen, about how these materials were in sex toys, and they were not healthy, and they were not a good idea to be having in sex toys. And so Carol came back, and we all sort of freaked out and had this big conversation. It actually took some time before Good Vibrations was able to sort of eliminate phthalates from its product line. And now all of the, I don't want to say all, but the majority of, I get a lot of sex toys for review in my role at Erosazine. Yeah, for review. And a lot of them will say no phthalates, particularly Topco, which is one of the big manufacturers, sends me a lot of stuff, and a lot of it says no phthalates. Specifically, because there's been sort of this move on the part of consumers to be nervous about this, and also the EU, for instance, banned phthalates in children's toys some time ago, and there's been a lot of movement on this. But it was really pressure from not at all from the commercial industry to do this. It was pressure from more activist groups. So I think that's a really important point to make. And that's one place. There are a million other unsafe sex toys. Violet Blue, actually, who spoke earlier, has a really good section on unsafe sex toys and unsafe sex products on her website. And but in general, it is, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there marketed that is really harmful. Analyze is one of the favorites, but there are actually a lot of them. There are even some products that were found in some cases in women to cause, I think, heart attack and stuff like that. I think I want to say it was an Analyze-like product, but I don't remember specifically what it was. So a lot of this stuff is really, really dangerous. And that's one place where peer education can help.
And the other part of that you were mentioning is that having been a sex educator for so long, you've really seen the technologies of sex education itself and educating the educators kind of evolve. And you said you wanted to speak to that. So
yeah, the culture of sex education has really grown with San Francisco Sex Information, where we've gone from trying to educate people who would answer the phones and then later who would answer emails about on sexual questions. We now see a much larger percentage of people who are already educators, who are podcasters, who are bloggers, a lot of bloggers, a lot of people who are doing websites, a lot of people who are doing home sex parties and stuff like that. It's completely changed the discourse because sex education is happening on so many different fronts, and I think the web has made that happen a lot. Similarly, we used to really have to struggle to find media of particular that fit particular criteria when educating sex educators. You want to be able to show media that represents, you know, I hate to use this term, but represents quote-unquote real people having sex or sort of reflects more common behaviors. And I hate to use the term real people because it implies that porn stars aren't real people or that nobody wants to have porn star sex. It even kind of implies that nobody wants to look at porn or commercial porn, which is not at all true. I mean, those are real people. They're having real sex, and they're getting paid for it. But generally speaking, it was very hard to find materials that didn't sort of fit porn criteria and therefore punch people's porn buttons, which can interfere with somebody's sex education experience when they're learning about sex education to watch, if they've never seen gay male porn before, for instance, for them to see, you know, really kind of tarted up, slicked up commercial gay porn may push different buttons than if they're seeing, you know, a sort of real life gay couple having sex together on maybe a little bit less high quality video. Well, stuff like that was, you know, quote unquote real couples or that reflected private life more in media was very, very, very hard to find when I started. And the first training that I went through at San Francisco Sex Information was really outdated media. It was media mostly from the 70s. And this was sort of at the beginning of the video revolution, and video, the cost of video went down so radically that now it's just much easier for us to find. You know, I mean, it changes every training that we give, but we show pony videos, we show a much greater scheme of BDSM videos, and it's really, I think, revolutionized the way sexual information is communicated because it's so much easier to do it on video specifically. So,
great. Well, I think at this point I'd like to open it up to the audience, but before I do that, I wanted to know if you had any closing remarks or.
I think the web is a net gain for sex education. I think that we have to really be aware of how much sexual pressure the utopian ideal of being sex educators puts on people, because I know that this has always been a challenge for people, I think, doing sex education in San Francisco. We want to put out this idea that everybody can have all, you know, the kind of sex they want to have, whatever it is, all the time, with whoever they want, and that's just not true. And I think that we need to be really aware of that as sex educators, that by selling sex too much as too perfect and too good and too positive, I think you're actually selling something that you really can't follow up on, because sex is problematic. And I think that sex education can make it a lot less problematic, but sex is never going to be perfect. And I think, you know, I think that we need to allow for the diversity of people's sexuality in the positive and negative. So
that's a really good point. I think that is probably one of the real shortcomings, as it were, of pornography, is that in providing a fantasy scenario, they're providing a fantasy that is lots of fun for everyone, or if they're not having fun, it's part of the fantasy. And one of the things that I think is a very important aspect of sex information and sex education is to talk about what happens when you're not enjoying yourself. How do you communicate with your partner about not enjoying yourself? How do you relax and realize maybe it's okay if you don't always enjoy yourself? So at this point, I would like to bring some of the audience into this, because I think that we're almost done, but I'd like to find out from you guys, what is it that you think that could be better about adult sex education? What is it that you would really like to see that you're not seeing? And I think that we have a fabulous brain trust here in this audience of those of you who have been willing to stick it out all day, who are still here and haven't gone home just yet. I would really appreciate any particular comments or questions you have from the audience.
So, any questions or comments?
People should be out there to tell people that there is such a thing as bad sex, and it happens a lot.
How do you handle the flood of misinformation or poor information out there, and how do you convince people or let them know that there's good information out there, there's bad information out there? If you've got people who don't know, say you're talking about basic biology, how can they distinguish good from bad information when they've got no idea what they're looking for?
That, I think, is a basic question of media literacy in general. How can you decide if something seems to be legitimate information, right? We all have this problem when we're trying to seek accurate news, too. But in terms of the sexual realm, you get a lot more people who are amateurs who are providing information, and the rest of us going out trying to figure out what is and isn't legitimate. Now, I think in the same way with regular media literacy, one of the ways that you can try to figure this out is to take a look at your available options in terms of education and look at their credentials. Have they been doing this for a very long time? Are they well respected by other people in the same field? Do they have any sort of publication? And obviously that's not going to necessarily do everything for you, but that's one of the ways. And the other is to really just become a very savvy media consumer. And we get this with just about any media, same with news, with any sort of advertising. In terms of who is and isn't a legitimate expert, that's really your best bet. Also, another way you can do this is by fact-checking, finding multiple sources, especially in terms of the biology. If you go see something on one particular website that seems a little bit dubious, maybe you should go check out medical textbooks. It's a little bit more work, but it does ensure that your information is a little bit more accurate.
I'm going to actually make a comment that's based on a guitar amplifier that I was looking at. Somebody online posted that this one particular headphone guitar amplifier had a speaker on it because it had a picture of a speaker on the box. And my point about this is that people will post complete misinformation crap, and the only way to be able to tell what's good sex information, particularly medical information, is to be skeptical of everything you read. There's a certain point at which you have to be willing to take at face value, and you do that by checking references. And I think this media literacy is a very important point, and I think that that it's something that we don't teach as a culture at all, to be able to be literate.
But how do you teach that kind of skepticism to someone who's 15 and doesn't understand that I need to check my sources, or that I'm embarrassed and I can't talk to an adult, and I'm teaching myself this from the places, the source I'm finding, and they might be completely legitimate sources, but how do you ensure their interpretation is an accurate interpretation of what they're reading and being able to apply?
Well, in terms of 15-year-olds, we do see this a fair bit with the VP forum. If any of you want to check it out, it is a live journal community called Vagina Pagina. It's a Spanish word for page, so V-A-G-I-N-A-P-A-G-I-N-A. And one of the things that I think works really well in our favor is that there are a lot of people in that same demographic there. So people can feel fairly comfortable, because one of the things that's nice is we have members that range from, you know, about 14 or so onwards up into their 70s who answer questions. Probably by far the average is between, say, 16 and 30. But even so, you see people in all phases of their lives, people who are teenagers and young, just starting out, people who are adults with kids. And one of the things that's nice is that everybody is kind of on an equal level there. Nobody is like, oh, well, you're just a kid, because that kind of attitude just doesn't really fly. We treat people like equals. And so when people are a little bit more embarrassed, coming into a situation where their embarrassment is respected is really important. There's definitely an easy tendency to feel like, oh, you're embarrassed about that? Hey, what's up? But when we realize there's stuff I'm still embarrassed about, there's stuff everybody's embarrassed about, and when we can respect that kind of shyness, I think people are a lot more comfortable opening up. And once people find one location that they're comfortable in, that they feel has some sort of valid information, they can start to learn skepticism from there when they meet other people, when they get to talk to other people and get a kind of a sense of the greater community.
That's that leads to basically what I was going to say, which is that assuming that you can't just take somebody who's 15 who's just emailed San Francisco sex information or gone to Vagina Pagina and teach them skepticism, you know, that took the Western world thousands of years to develop. The best thing to do is to teach them to trust a few sites that are trusted by other people who know what they're doing. And there are some really good sites, and basically to teach them to rely on the places that are reliable, I think is real important. That's a good kind of baby step or interim point.
An area that I've found seems to be particularly confusing in how it's handled in online sex education, I think, is the issue of sexually transmitted diseases. While the basic facts of the diseases themselves are pretty readily available in terms of how a person should react to those diseases, because everyone's attitudes are different, if I were to go search for, say, HPV on the internet, I'd find some sites that said if you'd had it and cleared it, you don't even have to tell your new partners. Some sites talk about it like if you've touch somebody with HPV that you're a leper for the rest of your life. Obviously, most of them are somewhere in between, but people, I think, don't seem to realize that. I think the biggest problem is that few people are saying there is no right answer. Not enough people are saying that. Like, you know, I think that, you know, obviously each person has to decide for themselves what's my acceptable risk, but that's not something that seems to be getting reinforced as much as I guess I'd like to see.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That's something that we should have mentioned. STD information is so variable. It changes so rapidly. This is an area where there is a fair amount of medical research, the other one being pharmaceuticals into sexuality. It is the information is so conflicting. It's all over the place. It's very difficult. You talk to any one sex educator, you're going to get different information. It's not, you know, when you're talking about HIV, there's a whole community around it. When you're talking about something like herpes or HPV, there's a lot of gray areas and there's a lot of confusion. I got to say, it's always very difficult to know how to tell somebody to get good STD information. And I think, again, you just have to ask them to rely on particularly, you know, reliable sites and reliable sources. But it's very difficult. I think Planned Parenthood in general is totally on the forefront of this. For a long time, Scarlet Teen has been very good. Particularly for age appropriate information for people who are under 18 is really good. And it's other than that, you know, do you know a few good sites for STD information?
Well, I think the ones that you mentioned are really up there. I think SFSI, for that matter. And one of the things that I wanted to speak to, though, is what you're asking about isn't so much about sexual transmitted diseases in terms of medical information, but in terms of attitude, right? What you're bringing up is, are you a leper? And obviously that's not literally the case, so the question is, are you a pariah? And that's really a question of social attitudes. What is a moral judgment? At what point do I feel like I morally must, do I need to tell other partners? And that's one of those things that is going to be an individual judgment. I think there's a lot of things that, yes, we'd probably agree. If you have HIV, you should tell your partners, right? I think we can all agree with that. But there are some of these questions where I see varying attitudes in different social circles. To give one example, herpes 1, formerly known as oral herpes, but the sort of less invasive form of HSV, some people seem to think that this is a terrible, terrible disease. You should join herpes personal sites and never meet anybody without telling them, even before you go on a date. Whereas other people don't even find this something worthy of talking about until maybe they've had a long-term relationship with somebody. And because it's not a fatal disease, that's one of those things that I'm a lot more willing to leave up to somebody's personal life, to somebody's social circle, and their own community, kind of the community standards model. But when we're talking about something that is potentially fatal, I think that there is a moral imperative to let people know what they're getting into. So it's a little bit more variable. What you're going to get along those lines is really dependent upon the community that you ask and the community that you're talking to. And that's one of those things I think that I'm much more willing to let people kind of figure out on their own.
I think it's an important point to make that this really is an area that different communities have very different standards on it. If you're in a gay male sex club and before you give somebody head, for instance, you say, oh, I'm HIV positive, you're going to really stand out like a sore thumb. It's going to be very unusual behavior. Whereas other places, you know, people would be horrified to think about having any interaction, even a kiss, without somebody disclosing that. I think it just really depends on where you are. It's really an individual decision for each person.
I have an additional question. We're talking about sex education and the lack of sex education, and I think most of the male people in Western society are being sex educated by pornography. I mean, you're 12 years old, you download your porn, you watch it, and then you get a pretty specific view upon sexuality. So women are always available, they're always willing, blah 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 blah, the whole thing. So how could we and that's not a good thing. I mean, life doesn't work like the way that porn works. So how could we stop this strange circle of bad sex education? People are educating themselves via pornography, and then we have this vicious circle.
I think personal contact is the best way. I think that the thing that countermands I'm not anti-porn in any way, fairly obviously, I think. but I think that there is a negative influence that pornography has, which is exactly as you say it, that it puts out this kind of ideal of of what sex is and what partnering looks like. That's just not anything like it is in the real world. Unfortunately or fortunately. And I think that the thing that makes, I'm going to speak for myself here. When I got to an age where I actually was able to have sex with other people, the thing that made it better than pornography was that it was real and that it was intimate and immediate. And I think that that right there is kind of a metaphor for what it's like to actually have a sexual conversation with somebody rather than having the appeal of pornography. At the same time, I don't think you're ever going to make pornography not appealing, and you're never going to, it's never going to be good porn if it's not more appealing than real life. So I think it's an ongoing challenge.
Well, one of the things, when we're talking about somebody who's a teenager or who's fairly young, 12, 10 years old, just discovering this, is that we have to realize that there's some responsibility on the parents, too. And not only the parents, but other adults in that young person's life. So one of the things is we do have to walk kind of a fine line, because there is a lot of hysteria about child abuse and there is a lot of child abuse. But for those of us who are adults who know young people, we have to be willing to discuss some of this with younger people, because I think it's pretty clear that if you look at any mainstream movie, right, an action film, right, real life isn't actually like that either. And one of the better ways to kind of communicate that to a kid, if they are coming to, they're finding pornography and they're wondering, hey, is it really like that, is to kind of show them, well, you watch Die Hard, do you know anybody who goes through anything like that? And that has to be something that an adult is willing to talk to a young person about. One of the things that's very difficult with that is that if you're not a parent, people are often very, very worried about talking to younger people about sexuality. They're worried about saying the wrong thing. They're worried about coming off as a sleazeball, especially to that younger person's parents. So you kind of have to walk a fine line with being willing to mentor people without going into too explicit of details about your own sexuality, maybe, but being willing to answer questions, being willing to say, hey, this is a fantasy, but then so is the Transformers movie, and you understand that, right?
The one thing, now with Johannes's frage about Johannes's frage, Johannes's question about the about pornography as a form of sex education for young men. The thing is now, obviously I just told you I had access to porn as a child or teenager. The thing is that for me, I was always able to separate that porn had nothing to do with reality. That was like a pure fantasy thing for me. I don't know where I got that message. I was not taught to be media literate any more than anybody else was. But there was that separation. What was much more problematic for me was growing up as the son of a hairdresser and spending all my free time reading Cosmopolitan and a lot of mainstream media, which was packaged, is packaged much more as a real thing. And at that time, that would have, around the 80s, there was the whole discussion, you know, and especially in that magazine, what's the perfect man? What is it like? What is his behavior supposed to be? And you started, for me, getting into that whole issue of male identity, what's proper behavior, what's expected behavior, what is right in sex, and because this was supposedly a serious, or it was normal media, I accepted that actually as much more given, and it had a much stronger influence on me and forming my ideas and attitudes than any of the pornography that I ever read did, because that was, it was always clear to me. So it gets down for me back to the issue of media literacy. The same as with the issue with sexually transmitted diseases, as with which websites can you trust. I had enough literacy to be able to say that pornography is maybe not where I get my trust my information, but I didn't have enough to be able to step back far enough from classic women's magazines at the time.
Yeah. Which is that at one point, though, is it that parents don't realize that pornography isn't what real sex is like. I mean, there's an uncomfortability where they think there's something wrong with their sexuality because they're not having porn star sex. So how can they then translate that to their children? And is that something, like, I haven't been to Scarlet Teen. I've read about Scarlet Teen. Is that the kind of thing that's talked about there?
Well, that's where things like San Francisco Sex Information and other sex information sites for adults come in. Is as soon as we need to educate everybody kind of at the same time. I mean, in other realms, I know parents have talked about their kids kind of educating them as they help their children with the math homework and they learn the math themselves that they didn't know before. It's kind of the same thing. Parents need to be open to maybe learning new things, and maybe not with their child, because that could be a world of awkward, but but perhaps their children's questions could go spur them to find some of this information on their own. Again, this isn't an ideal world where parents care and they're involved, and you know, we'd like to hope that this is the case, but unfortunately it's not. So, I mean, I can sit here and talk about what parents should do and shouldn't do the whole day, and they're not necessarily going to listen to me. But the way that we can kind of work with this is to have sex information that's available to people of all age ranges at the same time. And so when one person is interested, hopefully they can kind of start a domino effect in their world when they ask their peers and their parents and their friends, and those people go searching for that information themselves.
I think your point about the women's magazines, and I would include in that what I got my first sex information from, which is sex guides for women, and your point about do parents know that this isn't real, I think is a very good point. I mean, I came of age in the 70s. I read this stuff in the 70s and early 80s. You know, the sex guides were really utopian. They were like, boy, you can have it all. And the women's magazines, 10 times more so. They were like, you can have it all, and you can do this, and you can do that.
No
erectile dysfunction. I mean, a lot of things were not talked about, and I think that's a good point, that parents may know that pornography is not real. They may not know that Cosmopolitan isn't real, because that's a fantasy that we as a culture have so much need to believe in. And I think it's as true of men as it is of women, but it's a different kind of magazine. I think it's Lad magazines to a lesser extent. It's Playboy and stuff like that. But definitely I think Cosmopolitan was, you know, was and continues to be this dream that that society needs to believe in. And I think parents are more likely to believe in that than they are to believe in pornography as reality. So I think it's a very good, those are two very good points.
I think it's also really important in like the whole question leading into the question of media literacy is also like how many people realize that maybe Oprah or Dr. Drew or Sexline or whatever is not reality either, which seems to be, you know, it's like a format in which someone's being set up as an expert. People come to them for questions, they answer, they seem wise, and it's kind of difficult to know how to thread through that and kind of cut away the bullshit.
Oh, you? Yeah, not long ago. Yes. Long ago, I had a comment about the parenting part. I have kids. But in addition to the, I think you said, if you don't have kids, it's you have to worry because it's kind of creepy and so on. Even if you have kids, it feels really creepy to have conversations with other people's kids. It's, or even the idea of it, it feels very... very scary, not just about sex, but really about a lot of things. It's like you have to be on guard, or at least you have this sense of being embattled.
The greatest fear is like pedophilia.
Oh, God. Yeah, yo, no, yeah.
The level of awareness about that, you can't even like
no,
that's, child without being accused.
Yeah,
being
no.
A sex offender.
I had this this experience. My son, my 8-year-old, was in the shower at the pool, came out, and I get called over, I guess, and some awful woman was there, and her son, who was slightly younger than Spencer, and Spencer had been playing in the shower and doing stuff and spitting water at each other and whatever, and she said that her son had told him that Spencer was touching his penis and wouldn't stop when he asked him. Well, I don't know what happened. I can't know what happened. I talked to Spencer later. I didn't make a big deal about it. I talked to him and I said, "So what happened? Talk to me about this." And he told me this thing, and he stopped spraying. They were spraying, spitting at each other, mouthfuls of water. And Spencer stopped when the kid said to stop. And then the kid spit at him. And apparently not just once or whatever. And so obviously that meant that he could retaliate. I mean, that's like, of course you can. You know, that makes perfect sense in that way. And he had this big, you know, long conversation about that. And I said, well, what about this other thing? He said, oh. And he had just this blank look. It was like, huh? And I have this high sense. And I told him, I told Spencer this. I said, well, no, like people are raised now in fear. And I don't know what happened in there. And either you touched him, in which case you probably shouldn't, or you didn't. And this is an important lesson, that this is the most powerful tool that a lot of kids have now, because they've been raised in fear. And so the most powerful tool they have to get believed, to get taken seriously, is to say someone touched them. And that doesn't mean that people don't ever get touched or abused. It means this is the most powerful tool. And we had this long conversation about, like, you know, should the woman have believed her son or not, and, you know, introduced decision theory and all kinds of things to him. But no, it's freaky. It's.
I just want to say that I think that that is a symptom of a culture that doesn't take kids seriously when they talk on any topic that treats children like they're ineffectual or like they're unimportant as a culture, and I think that's really unfortunate.
Well, and one of the protections against this, if you are an adult and want to speak with a young person about something that's a sexual topic but don't really want to have to worry about this, you know, am I the sleazeball, is to stay informed about what the resources are, right? Is maybe you're not comfortable having that discussion, but you can point them to a website like Scarleteen. Or you can get them a book of information, like the Our Bodies, Ourselves book, and say, okay, well, I'm not sure I'm up for having this conversation, but here's a resource that I know is good, and I can tell you that the information here is going to be good, so take a look at this. And I realize that that's not perfect, that's not the best option, but it does provide a sort of somewhat more anonymous model for still providing information and providing a responsibility without having to worry about later being accused of goodness knows what. Anyways, we should probably have maybe one more comment, and then I think
yes.
We're about done.
This is actually a question about something you mentioned earlier and kind of relating to Mark Derry's speech earlier. He was talking about how the pornotopia sort of brings everything out into the open, and you were talking about sort of the fragmentization into fetish communities online. I guess I'm wondering whether you think there are actually new fetishes coming out of the internet, or whether it's really just that the old desires are coming out. Because I've encountered a few things that seem like they couldn't exist without, say, Photoshop. And so I guess I'm just sort of wondering what you guys think as sex educators, whether you're seeing things that really are new, or whether they're just variations of old kinks, or whether they're old kinks all over the board that just now are out in the open and maybe have names.
Well, I have to mention, one of my favorite ridiculous internet fetishes is the Boytar website. I don't know if you've seen this. But it seems to be a fantasy site about men with multiple legs, and instead of hands, feet at their wrists. Yeah, I'm not kidding. Go look it up. There's a whole series of stories and Photoshop images. But while this does seem a little bit out there, we've always had art, right? Humanity has always had the capability of drawing. We've had the capability of writing and of imagining ridiculous things. If you want to consider the multi-limbed deities of the Hindu pantheon, I doubt that there's people writing erotica about them, but there might be, and there probably is now. So I think there is, now that I've mentioned it, right? It's that law of internet fetishes. Yeah, extra hands, no feet. But at any rate, we've always had the capability to imagine. So I think that maybe one person's imaginings are now kind of writ large. As one person thinks of something, puts it out on the internet, and other people say, oh, hey, that's kind of cool. But I don't think that we're necessarily coming up with things that are totally new, right? Because we've always had the capability of drawing things and painting things and writing things. But what do you think?
I think that I'm perfectly willing to say that I think for certain people, new fetishes and discovering new fetishes is actually thrill-seeking behavior, and can in some cases be a little pathological or a little bit problematic for them. And I think that once you get really into pornography, and particularly into fetish pornography, I think that you look for new turn-ons, and I think sometimes people will find something that will obsess them. At the same time, there are things that will obsess the same person for years and years and years, and only that thing will obsess them. I don't know what the answer is, whether any of that is new. But I definitely think that the internet and Photoshop and new technologies provide opportunities to view your particular fetishes and to discover new fetishes. So yeah, I think new stuff is developing all the time would be my assertion.
Yeah, I have to add one of my personal fetishes, but that's a kind of an interesting story. It's a guy who dedicated like his whole life to dinosaur porn. So he is basically, his fetish is dinosaurs having sex. And his special fetish is that a dinosaur would crush himself and use himself as a lubricant. And I think that blows my mind, I tell you. And I hope it blew your mind, and I'm pretty sure that the whole day blew your mind. So wonderful that you were here such a long time. Applause for you. Applause for our panel.